to start the recording. And, So, good. With a little delay, we are going to start. So, in this lecture, entitled Social Computing and Social Gaming, the first three or four lectures will talk about social games and social media, right? And the story, as I probably have told you already, is that we are going to emphasize the commonalities between those two types of applications. So for the social computing students, it is certainly an interesting and important topic to also talk about social games. Because when these two things kind of flow together, social media and social games, it's naturally of interest for the social gaming and for the social computing students, as well as the other way around, social media is for the games engineering students. So that justifies why we are going to talk about games in the social computing class as well, right? So the first slide set is on games in general and their social aspects. And the second slide set that we will be probably talking about next week is about social media, right? I've shortened this down from the previous semester where a lot of you were, the students from the last semester were complaining that it's too theoretical and too much things that we've already heard of. So I will, quite quickly go about or over certain details on these slides. Okay? As for all the slides, there's a background reading, and the background reading is a master's thesis of a student of mine. We assembled this together, intended as a script for this lecture, so it's about 100 pages. For those that are interested in these, what are games, what is play, what are the philosophical aspects of it. So if you're interested, you are cordially welcome to dig a bit deeper with the help of this thesis, which I'm going to put online right after this lecture. Okay? So, as I said, we'll go quickly over some things. As for the exam, right? It is of natural interest for the students, obviously, what part of the lecture is relevant for the exam. And I would put it that way, since these things are, a bit hard to actually learn, because we're not philosophers, we're not, in the first place, social psychologists, I would skip the first slide set or exempt it from the exam, right? So lean back, don't worry about details missing, it'll not be relevant for the exam, just this first slide set, okay? Good. Now, certainly, almost all the lecturers in the games engineering process study will have presented a slide that somehow goes like this, which emphasizes or puts an emphasis on the importance of games, right? And so this is a citation emphasizing this, important role that games probably play and will play in the future, right? So there's certain perspectives on digital games, okay? So we can view it from, at least four perspectives. So there's the researcher's perspective, and the guys and girls that do these things are called ludologists, right? And they would probably use scientific methodologies, right? There's a lot of empirical studies out there investigating games and players of games and aspects of games that I will make use of and that have been made use of in this thesis. And so the three most important scientific methodologies that would be used is empirical. It is also deductive in a sense where some parts of the ludologists would kind of work on more formal mathematical game theoretical frameworks to decide, so then they would have to use mathematical reasoning as a scientific methodology, but there's also design science. And that is something that's very, very important for you as computer scientists, which I presume most of you are, since the design science circle starts with a conception of some design, some object, some entity that kind of is a candidate for solving human problems, right? So for the engineer, the human problem is the starting point, and the goal is to produce scientific knowledge that kind of contributes to the solution spectrum for these kind of problems. And you would always have these devise, implement, test circles in design science. However, besides the researchers, we could also view games from the game developer point of view, which is more or less really a different point of view. Game designers are not necessarily the ones that implement. So in the first task of the lab course for the gamers, we saw the difference between implementation and design. And naturally, gamers themselves have also perspective on difficult games. So we're in some, as for ludology, we're in some intersection of some areas, right? So there's certainly these human-centered sciences as psychology, sociology, and so on. Naturally, informatics, computer science, but also economy and arts, right? So the narratology of games is something that is certainly in the focus of arts, like scripts and films and stuff, and there is certainly a business model that is relevant for the game. So all these things that are in the intersections can be subsumed under the field of science that we might call ludology, like from Latin ludus, the game, right? Good. So in that thesis, background reading, we devise ordering schema for games that we use to talk about them in this introduction, right? So at the core, we distinguish game type and game genre, which I will elaborate on today and tomorrow. And certainly there are descriptive aspects that are also of interest for ludologists, like the business model, which is obviously more to the economy side, technical platform, visual design, narrative structure, socio-psychological aspects, and a lot more. Okay, and we're not going to cover all of them. We would just shed a rough light on some of these aspects. Okay, now, before we talk about social games, we need to talk about what is play and what is a game, naturally. And that is something that I presume also has been talked about in previous lectures, so we will go over that quite quickly. Now, the following definitions are chronologically ordered in a chronological fashion. So in the 1930s, there was a cultural historian from Holland, which kind of came up with this definition of play, right? And I kind of emphasized the aspects that are relevant for us here in the social gaming lecture with this blue boxes behind us, right? So we see that game is free. It does not correspond to material interest, which is not necessarily true. Think of gambling. And so on and so on. So these two that are relevant for us is the second, that it kind of play or games kind of stand outside ordinary life, in a sense, right? So they're not serious. And that is certainly something we have to discuss in view of social media and social games floating together. Because we will see in pervasive games and all these categories that it's not necessarily true that games are outside ordinary life, especially for digital mobile pervasive games. The sixth point is quite interesting because it is
Yeah, well, striking that almost all the researchers and the philosophers and cultural historians emphasize the social relevance of games in general, right? So Huizinga says it promotes the formation of social groupings. And the rest of the sentence is rather strange. With disguise, he means that there's things like uniforms, guilds with their own culture and stuff. So these are rather strange words, but keep in mind, it's from the 1930s. Okay? Now, Roger Calvois, in the 1960s, kind of picked that up and, well, straightened some of the logical issues of the first definition. So, for example, he emphasized that games are unproductive, meaning that they're not generating goods or services, however they may certainly be of monetary value. You know that in Korea, for example, there's professional players that earn money and so on. However, there's still aspects that can be questioned, and the 1960s were certainly ahead of the digital age, right? And he kind of further came up with this classification for games, which kind of emphasized competition, chance, simulation, and, well, things that are more related to your bodily perception, right? But these people skip, it's not very, very interesting for us at the moment, right? So in the 1970s, late 1970s, other aspects came around, right? Which emphasized more the attitude and other aspects of games, which kind of, well, emphasized, for example, rules and the socio-psychological state that you try to achieve or try to be in, right? However, it is not until the late 1990s that people talked about or kind of focused on digital games, right? And in this definition by, or these kind of motives by Sutton Smith, we would find the fourth one quite interesting, right? So with the first one, he means that play does not only kind of encompass playing an ego shooter, but it also encompasses little children playing around with their toys and their puppets, trying to kind of play against the unknown surroundings that they have in order to develop their brains, their perception, their manual skills, and so on. Okay? Now that is meant by play as progress, and he has other of these categories such as play as fate, for gambling and stuff that's very probabilistic and so on. However, the fourth point, play as identity, kind of stresses that people would kind of define themselves over their playing behavior, right? And identities of within communities and off communities are also formed by games and players and this intersection, right? So it's an important motive here that already points to the social domain. And there's certainly other things that are that Sutton Smith mentioned, which we will not go into. For example, the stuff that like playing around, which he calls play as the frivolous, okay? However, good, thank you. So, how can we sum that up? So, there's countless other definitions around there, and we will stick to one by Salem and Zimmerman. Perhaps you know the book by Salem and Zimmerman, which comes up in a second. However, it is obvious that it's not so easy to define these terms properly, right? So, it's not easy to define what is play, and it's not easy to define what is a game and what is not a game, which kind of points to the fact that the boundaries are, in a sense, blurry and fuzzy. And it's also conceptually interesting because play and game kind of stand in a complicated algebraic relationship. Yeah? So Zale and Zimmerman said that play is a key aspect of games, yeah? And games are also vice versa related to play, right? But we won't dig into that because that's more to the philosophy side. What is interesting is that in most definitions, we find these social aspects, right? Explicitly or implicitly. And if you read the corresponding texts, for example, by this Dutch cultural historian, besides those definitions, he also makes statements that games are like a means to form social groupings. And Sutton Smith, in turn, kind of emphasizes the community identity that's conveyed by playing games. Okay? Now,
we will now switch to a more, from this philosophy point of view, we will switch more to a game researcher's perspective and focus more on digital games, right? So, Zale and Zimmerman, who knows the book by Zale and Zimmerman, hands up? Not one of you, so that's a rather interesting and well-written book about ludology that I can recommend. And however, you can also stick to the thesis as background reading. So in terms of defining the intersection between play and game, these two persons would emphasize like a hierarchy, okay? So at the outer layer, there's a state of being playful, yeah, which corresponds to the illusory attitude of suit that we had briefly on those slides. And being playful is like an umbrella term. You could also transfer it to, well, I'm gonna let my Facebook page pop up and see what my friends are doing. Right? This is, in a sense, a social communicative playful state, in a sense. And a subset of being playful are the ludic activities, which would include almost anything, like driving some weird roller coaster at the reason, whatever. It's also part of this non-serious thing, but it's not a game per se. And the gameplay is the innermost section there. Okay. Now, Zale and Zimmerman try to define what is a game, and we see that they say it's a system where players engage in an artificial conflict, which is governed by rules, and that results in some quantifiable outcome. As with almost all these definitions, you can raise your hand, wait a minute, World of Warcraft, quantifiable outcome, yes or not, really, but there's no true winner. Yeah, things are ongoing, right? So you have to be cautious with these definitions. However, most of these things, like rules and engagement and system and so on, I think are rather agreeable, okay? Conflict is another thing that this competitive aspect. Most of games have these competitive aspects, but not necessarily all of them. So I'll introduce you to a version of serious game where we might have that in a more mild form, okay? And others kind of also emphasize, once again, social things, systems that build behavior via interaction. And Dormans emphasizes that games are something that is emergent from its rules, right? So emergence is... Cookie does not know what emergence is, okay? Because there are only very few, so I can skate and skip. So it's more or less the phenomenon that things constitute a whole, and the properties of the whole are not easily identified from the properties of the constituent elements, right? Like an ant or beehive, right? Which is a complicated biological organism that has behavior which is not easily explained from the single bee and single ant's capabilities, right? It's a synergetic, emergent state, right? Good. Which brings us to their aspects, which are quite interesting. And so they would also, Zale and Zimmerman would also kind of emphasize this emergent nature. And in terms of social media, we would find that as well, right? So the single blog and the single social networking platform is nothing without its users, and it's nothing without the content, and nothing without the emergent behavior that people show and exhibit when they occupy such a medium, right? So there's a whole culture
developing around these technical opportunities, right? What they also emphasize is that games can be viewed as information theory systems, right? So who does not know what information theory is? Okay, good. So there is no real opinion on that, but I presume that most of you have heard about that in the lectures concerning technical aspects of computer science, right? So what is an information? It's minus the logarithm of the probability and so on. But presumably you've heard of that, right? What's also interesting is games as game theory systems. And that's also something we will be talking about quite extensively at the end of this lecture. What are game theoretical systems? Utility, Nash equilibria, stuff like that. That's very commonplace, for example, in theoretical business science or economy, right? Good. Zale and Zimmerman also emphasize social aspects, naturally, as you might have imagined. So the first statement is that, or points to the fact that the relationships between elements in many game systems can be considered to be social relationships of some sort, right? So very many games that stress artificial relations between like avatars or small figures or whatever kind of build on the pre-formed elements in your brain that are kind of targeted towards social interaction, yeah? In the magazine, I read an article about what makes humans intelligent, or what enables humans to bring about all these technological interesting things. And in the article, it said, well, it's not so much about intelligence or analytic capabilities. Modern zoology or animal science brought up new insights that apes and chimpanzees and stuff are capable of wondrous analytic and intelligent feats. And they're even better at some things like automatic classification than humans, right? And it's not about this deductive capability. So what makes humans strong is their social abilities, which surpasses all of the animal kingdom, right? So when you kind of decide that I'm a lecturer, and somebody bakes the bread, and somebody kind of fills these wooden chairs, and so on, so that we have a lot of trust in our societal rules, because there's nobody coming in and shooting me at the moment, because I know there's laws and stuff. So, and this, so these very fine-grained social abilities of humankind are the things that make us successful from an ego point of view, from an ecological point of view, that makes us a pest, right? Good. So they also say that games are emergent social systems, which kind of is something that I already explained. And they also introduce an interesting term, transformative social play, right? And that's about people taking over structures that they find in games or social media and fill them with new life. Okay, so they transform what they find in a social way, for example. Okay, and that also applies to the social relationships themselves, right? That's something we also find in social networking. Okay. Now, having heard all these things, what is a game, what is play, people might be tempted to kind of bring about a classification system, saying what is a game and what is not a game. And Jasper Juul had this kind of classification. So for him, their game or actual core games are defined by these elements. So they have rules, they have a variable outcome, which is valorized in terms of better and worse. The players have to invest an effort, which produces skills and so on. And these are elements that form games. And there's borderline cases, which we might view as games or not, and there are certainly things that are out, yeah, like storytelling or whatever. It also follows rules, but it does not have these core elements. However, we don't want to emphasize this a lot, okay? So each of you might come up with a definition of what is a game for her or him, but I mean, at the moment we have a intuition about what is a game, but we don't want to put that too strict. So there was a question. Okay, so what he was pointing to was that definition leaves out games like Minecraft. Okay.
For example.
Yeah, so the critique would be that Minecraft is not a game because?
The critique is that any definition which excludes things which are clearly games, such as that, are lacking.
Yeah, sure. I was just asking you about what particular was there in this Minecraft.
The variable, I believe, included the variable outcome, player attachment outcome.
Okay.
A free-form play right there. It's a variable rule.
Right. And we will get to that point. So his critique in terms of that game he mentioned not being a game in the sense of tool, but also maybe the pointogram is putting correctly to these three elements that kind of are outside these rather strict stuff here, right? And we'll get to this. Yeah.
Okay, so not the... You almost couldn't find any definition which would not be critiqued by some person or some advocate of some game. And that's only natural, right? Good. We can skip that, I think. So,
cool. Besides theorizing about what is a game and what is not a game,
point is to a threefold kind of division, stating that the game as a system is certainly something that can be defined or can be grasped as such. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about that. Then there's the players, and then there's the world kind of giving a frame that these players and the game are situated in. And that's something... The world delivers a context, and the context is something that you in the lab course are already trying to reason about, for example, the location-based context or the social context, and together with this emergent effect from transforming the rules into something new, right? That's where social play comes into the whole consideration. Okay, and that's where communities form, that's where rules are kind of transformed towards forming guilds and stuff. Okay? Good. Frasca is one of the more recent ludologists, and he also has a definition of play, which is not interesting for the moment, but in his definition of games, he kind of emphasizes one more time things that are interesting for us. So he emphasizes that games are by default social endeavors, which is kind of a bold statement. Think of an equal sugar, what kind of social endeavor would that be? However, we find that many social psychological traits are realized there. And he also kind of emphasizes that this performance measurement, this kind of valorization that I spoke of, which was in Jules' concept, for example, is valued to correlate to certain social standards. Okay? So there is something like points. Points merely resemble currency, resemble items of wealth. Okay? And here we'd be having a hard time to define valuation concepts in games that do not make a reference to social entities, right? Because points and valorization and winning is per se something social, since I'm trying to have more than others. Okay? Good. That's that. So from a game, these were point of view from game researchers, from ludologists. Now what about game designers? Yeah. So game design is often perceived as an art form, right? Like making movies, for example. Writing scripts. So that is at the boundary of producing literature, right? And the same is true for game design, which clearly has to do with graphical elements and aesthetics and so on. And in a sense, that's applied ludology. But the game designers might kind of say, no, that's not ludology. Ludology is way too academic. We're just in design. Yeah? However, one of them, which happens to be a ludologist at the same time, kind of, in his attempt to define games, also came up with two points that I'd like to emphasize. So, the interaction is something that we already talked about. That's something where people kind of inject their interpersonal elements in the game, right? And what comes into the play in the game for the first time now is that clearly games are of emotional significance. And we will look at systems for defining and kind of describing emotions from an algorithmic point of view. And there is also the second industry challenge pointing towards that. And that's also something that games have in common with social media. Because mobbing on Facebook is clearly a phenomenon that might kind of influence a 13-year-old's life substantially. If he's bullied by all of his or her classmates on Facebook, it certainly has an emotional significance. Not to speak of being addicted to games and so on. Now let's quickly look at players, okay? So once we've accepted that games are kind of social almost all the time, which is, as I said, a bold statement, we might have to look at what types of players are out there, okay? So, first of all, there's a subdivision by Joule, and he states that we either talk about hardcore players or casual players. That's something that I think most of you would also have in their vocabulary. Like, hardcore player is more like this nerdy type of totally immersed person with a high chance of being addicted to the gameplay, devoting a lot of time of his day or her day, while a casual player is more likely to play Farmville and stuff. Okay? Very informally. Now, Zale and Zimmerman kind of subdivided them in a more fine-grained way with respect to their illusory attitudes towards their illusory attitudes towards the game, right? So there's standard players, well, which is like the prototypical Mustermann type of squared a standard person. Then there is the dedicated player, which does not only follow rules, but does so devising his own or her own strategy. Then there's things like unsportsmanship playing, which kind of still follows the rules, but violates the spirit. So this is against these emergent type of transformative rules or laws that come up, which are not actually part of the game itself, but which are part of the culture that surrounds the game. And, there's the most extreme forms, the cheating player violating rules, and then the spoiled sport, which just rambles around and just doesn't care at all. Just the terrorist, the troll. Okay? Good. As I said, empirical studies are common among ludologists, so there's interesting statistical figures. Here there's an old study from 2006, which now is almost 8 years old, where we already see that some of the prejudices concerning games are not necessarily true, right? So the amount of female players is already half of
the gamers, which kind of contradicts the usual stereotype that the hardcore player is always a nerdy male,
yeah, which is not necessarily true. And at that time already, larger than 50% play on mobile devices, right, which is kind of interesting. And, has triggered, adult
gamers have spent 12 years of playing video games already,
so there is kind of a veteran type of persons out there already.
Now, having kind of qualified the players,
we might take a look at what are actual components of digital games. Once again, rather quickly. So, first component, which is
almost obligatorily, mandatorily present in games, is rules, right? So without rules, we couldn't have a game, at least not in the usual sense. And Zeno and Zimmerman kind of characterize them in a general way, and they also introduce certain types of rules.
Yeah. Like these that we might call constitutive, which are kind of form the core logic of the game. Operational rules, which have to do with the like the I/O and the setting in which it is played, but also these implicit rules, right? These are the ones that correspond to this transformative play. Yeah. And why did I put a blue box on or behind these first few characterizations?
Well, if you ask yourself the question, are these rules also present in social media?
Yeah. Are the rules explicit in social media? In a sense, not necessarily so, but there is stuff like the privacy settings on Facebook and that are also explicitly prescribed. There is, terms of operation, terms of conduct, that's also there. We're limited in our actions in social media. The rules are kind of fixed in a sense that their dynamics are rather small or rather low. So the rules in Facebook are not changing every day, although sometimes you have the impression that at least in aspects and so. They're binding because social rules are naturally something that
is very binding to us. So I cannot, for example, turn my back to you all the time, right? Because that's not considered to be polite, and I'm bound to following these rules,
right? Good. Good. Another interesting characterization of rules emphasizes that rules have to be viewed in terms of utility functions, okay?
So a player playing a game or a person using a social media will do so because he or she has an added value from doing so. So using this IT application will kind of raise her or his utility value. And that's something we will, as I said, find in game theory.
And it's also true for robots or multi-agent interactions, right?
If you look at Michael Bulrich's book on multi-agent systems, you would find that a lot of aspects are described in terms of utility, right? Even searching and wayfinding can be described in terms of utility, right?
And that's something that is quite important for us. Jules is also quite formal because he emphasizes that the rules kind of map the possible space of players' actions, transforming the state of the game. So what we get is a finite state machine, which might have a tree-like structure for simple adventure games, but might also be more of a complicated graph structure, right? Good. Good. So we can maybe skip that. Not so interesting. Now,
speaking of other components or elements of games, there's a ludologist, Hunicke, who kind of developed a
mechanics, dynamics, and aesthetics framework. Why is that interesting? Because we will be proposing to classify games in terms of their mechanics, right? And what do we understand by that? So that's the actions, behaviors, and control mechanisms that players have when playing the games. And also, together with the content that kind of feeds this machinery, okay? Then there's dynamics, which is kind of obvious, and aesthetics, I think, is also kind of obvious. Good. Järvinen also says that behavioral elements of the players are also naturally elements of the game itself, right? So how the players behave and how they play the game, in what environment, for example, in what context, does naturally influence the game and vice versa, okay? So what we see here is that besides all these other things that we have, like rules, themes, interfaces, and stuff, the behavioral elements are considered important components. If there's nothing like a culture, the game would not be interesting. Okay? Good. Speaking of game worlds game spaces, right? Certainly everybody has an intuition what is a game world or a game space. That we can pretty much take as a very general term of this imaginary space where the game actually takes place. So that can be the maze of Pac-Man at the very low end to up to the World of Warcraft or Second Life or whatever you want as a real, actual, virtual world. And there is a concept that is used by many ludologists, and that's called the magic circle. Okay? The magic circle is assumed to kind of delineate or demark the boundaries of the actual game from the world surrounding the game. And we already see that it's a dotted curve, which kind of suggests that it's not a real boundary in the literal sense. So that is the view most ludologists would take. But Jewell observed that there's a whole hierarchy of these magic circles. So in some games you would have the real world, which kind of gives a role model where the game designers use and project into the game world. And within the game world we also have subgames like levels and stuff. Okay, so what is the magic circle? I mean, it's a hierarchical thing, it's blurred. However, we all have an intuition about that in the single case. And once again, there's a parallel to social media, because clearly the boundaries between something that 10 years ago was called the virtual world and the boundaries towards the real world are kind of getting very blurred, because what happens in Facebook is something that's really true. You're sending messages to real people, which you're probably not going to do because nobody's using it these days anymore. However, it's not clear what is virtual and what is not, right? Good. Okay. We can skip that. Now, as for the classification, so we're still in the quest of trying to define what is social games, or what are social games, right? And in terms of doing so, you can come up with very many different classification schemas, and we try to come up with a twofold classification framework. And the first dimension is defined with respect to meta-types and types, and the second dimension is defined with respect to genres, okay? So, what are meta-types, okay?
In essence, what we will end up with is defining the type of the game as the cross product of, well, actual type and meter type. And if you look at games that kind of somehow involve social interaction,
which is maybe a working general definition for social games, what you would find is that there are these meter types. And this classification is probably not complete.
However, it encompasses very many types and meter types, especially of games.
And so actual social games are one meter type, right? But the others can certainly also have social elements, okay? And naturally, these things are overlapping. Because online and mobile, clearly, I mean, there's certainly games that are online, and there's certainly games that are online and mobile, and so on, right? Now, simulation, I think, is pretty clear. So the game, in a sense, simulates the real world. So an ego shooter simulates the real world in one or the other way. It's not social, right? Almost not necessarily so. Right, but it's a simulation game. World of Warcraft, in a sense, is a simulation that at least makes a lot of references to the real world in terms of movements and social interaction and so on. Right. This simulation type of meta type is certainly closely related to what we talked about as game mechanics and game physics. It's if you're trying to simulate, you have to do a lot of computations, like the persons at our faculty trying to simulate fluids and so on. Now, social games in the narrower sense would kind of require some social interaction in the game itself. May it be cooperative or may it be competitive, however, and this social interaction can take place inside of the game. Well, as a game element, but it can also be part of the culture surrounding the game. So it's, it takes place outside of the game. And
what we will always make a, as it were, generate as a term is that social games would generate social context and would in turn make use of social context. Social context will be a central element in this lecture, so we'll be defining it later in the second part in more detail, right?
Good. Online games, it's clear, they require some sort of web connectivity. Typical example are browser games. And mobile games
is something that I already talked about when I introduced the first task of the games engineering lab course, right? And mobile games make use of the context that arises through mobility, through movements that have the intention of changing the location of a person, right? Not movements like that, but movements like translatory movements. Everything that's connected with that. Being on vacation has to do with translatory movement, albeit at a temporal scale which is in the order of magnitude of 1 week or 2 weeks, right? But still, if you're on vacation, you kind of are in a context where you would consider yourself in a mobile situation, okay? And I talked about forms of context there in the sheet specifying the assignment, but I will also talk about context in the second part in more detail. However, one part I want to emphasize is that a truly mobile application, may it be a game or something else, would actually actively make use of the mobile context in some sense or the other. If it's just the smartphone UI that kind of lets you access something that is not truly making sense of making use of this mobile context, I personally wouldn't consider that a mobile game. It's just a normal game that can also be played when you're sitting somewhere. But if it does not take into account location, physical context, social context, or whatever,
I think it's not truly a mobile game. So that distinguish, things are something that I would like to emphasize. Yeah, so truly mobile, make use of social, of mobile context, whereas only accessed via mobile UI. Okay? Good.
So these were the meta tasks, yeah? Simulation, social, location-based, mobile. Okay?
Now, we said that there are also types of games. And these types are hardcore games, casual games, pervasive games, and serious games. And that's probably something that's more interesting for us here in the lecture. Okay? Once again, these types do not claim to be exclusive, and they do not claim to be non-overlapping. Okay? So,
what are hardcore games? So in essence, you might be more informed or more capable of defining what actually a hardcore game is than I am, right? So we can stick here to our intuition, as we did when we talked about hardcore gamers as persons. So a hardcore game certainly is something that involves players' immersion, in a sense, so being sucked into the game world. It is certainly often or primarily related to the meta-type simulation, and less so to online and social. Right? Primarily, hardcore games are simulation in that sense. Some types are like massive multiplayer online games, role-playing games, multi-user dungeons, which is more an ancient term that nobody uses these days, and even vintage classic games like Pac-Man, making use of also real-world analogs, like eating something and having a person and having other persons chasing them and so on. Right? Good. So they are often related, as you know, through high-end 3D graphics and so on. Now, casual games are a bit more interesting for us, because casual games, in a sense, are often or much, much more social than hardcore games, and they're also primarily online games. Okay? And what are the characteristics of casual games? Well, you can instantly play them without having to install something. They're easy to learn. You can quickly play them and then leave them alone again, so there's no real campaigns or stuff that you might be used to from adventure or shooters. And the social aspects via common play are also a typical characteristic of casual games. Okay? And Joule stated 5 design principles for casual games, or for a game to be casual. And that's, first of all, we, in almost all the cases, have positively balanced fiction. So there is no monsters and no evil horror splatter or chainsaw or killings in the casual games. At least the majority of them don't have. We could say, isn't Angry Birds actually a casual game? It is, and it's about shooting something. But it's much more, it's doing so in a much more abstracted form than whatever, Counter-Strike or Soldier of Fortune or whatever. They must be easy and yet seamlessly usable by the players, and they must be interoperable. You should be able to play in bursts like, oh my god, I want to have a 5-minute break from my coding, and when the boss comes in, I have to quickly be able to change screens without losing anything in my left, right? And they're often easy to play. The punishments when you lose are not that severe, and they're juicy in a sense. So they provide positive feedback in an excessive form, right? So that's what he characterizes as casual games. We all know examples of that. So browser games, like the stuff that the Zynga people do, social networking games played within social networking platforms or using the APIs of social networking platforms, like Farmville, which is a prototypical example. Downloadable casual games,
which are often associated with brands, like the famous Moorhuhn several, like 10 years ago. Don't know if you remember that. So obviously birds are clearly at the center of something being shot at in the minds of the game developers. And last but not least, most mimetic games, so those that use physical user interfaces like Kinect, Wii, Guitar Hero, whatever, can be considered casual as well. Okay? Now, good. So these were two. Now, pervasive games. What are pervasive games? We saw that casual games are certainly something that's relevant for this lecture because they're played in social networks and they're kind of social in many ways. Now, why are pervasive games interesting? Well, the answer is because pervasive games are games that kind of saliently violate the magical circle of playing games. They extend into the real world. They kind of blur up the boundary defined by the magic circle. They can do so spatially, yeah? So they can do so temporally, they can do so socially, in whatever. However, they kind of break through or expand these boundaries of what is still play and what is the real world, okay? And the same researcher that coined the first statement here on the slide also kind of came up with, if you want to tag well, with other terms. And we find a lot of stuff in there that we will be talking about, like context-aware games, games that make use of physical or social context, geo-games like geocaching and stuff, yeah. Location-based, whatever, mixed reality, augmented reality, games, all these things can be called pervasive, right?
Good.
There's other statements that kind of narrow that down a bit further. Yeah. So, for example, Kampmann and Walter kind of emphasize that UI elements such as wearable, mobile, computing, embedded systems, hardware, kind of facilitate something that we might call an environment for gameplay, yeah? Something that the gameplay can be suited in, okay? And a very interesting related term you might know from general computer science. So there's ubiquitous computing applications. So what's the difference between context-aware computing in informatics and ubiquitous computing? Now, ubiquitous computing stresses that there's computational resources all around us. So you can access the computational apps or resources everywhere, because there's connectivity everywhere and so on. And for example, also the Internet of Things is something that is part of ubiquitous computing. However, these ubiquitous computing resources can and will make use of context, but they should not necessarily have to, right? Which kind of distinguishes them from context-aware applications, which naturally are applications that make use of context in terms of improving something, but they would not necessarily have to be ubiquitous, lying around in space, right? Good. So the related meta types for these pervasive games are naturally mobile and location-based, but also social one more time. Yeah. So, some types of pervasive games. So smart toys are things that, for example, Gudrun Blinker is also investigating in her group together with these augmented reality aspects. Effective gaming is something that was brought up in the context of effective computing, right?
And effective computing is a term coined by Rosalind Picard. She's actually an electrical engineer working at MIT Media Lab, which is, you might heard of, one of the, or used to be like several years ago, one of the elite institutions in terms of
new media games and all these other things, and still is, right? If you happen to be around in Boston and you happen to know someone that lets you in that social media building, go there. It's interesting what these guys are thinking about, right? And Ross Picard was one of the first researchers that tried to measure emotions with the help of social signal processing techniques. Yeah? I talked about that already, watching your face, watching the expressions in your face, listening to your voice, and trying to decipher the prosody that kind of transports social signals and behavioral cues and so on. And effective gaming
was like a thing that kind of came along with that.
So it's natural to assume that these things have applications in games. And in the last lab course task or assignment, you will be asked to kind of find them with a creative software that has been designed at our chair. Okay? Now, augmented tabletop stuff. So you have a tabletop UI, maybe in that angle or face up, where you can actually interact with gestures like the smartphone, and you can place things on top of that. Yeah? Like cubes and stuff that are recognized by the system, which kind of extend the virtual space happening in the computer system, where this is just the screen, from the real 3D world. Okay, and that's called tangible UIs, and also something that has been pioneered by the guys at Media Lab. Right? Geocaching, you know, augmented reality is something that is clearly a pervasive subtype. And a general pervasive trend, I might say, is gamification, right?
So gamification states or describes that game elements like scores, high scores, rules, and stuff like that are integrated in other applications, other general computer science applications.
So that's a very general term. And it's clear why this is under the term of pervasive, okay?
Now,
second to last, or last, if I'm not completely mistaken, yeah, last already.
Last type is serious games, games of a purpose. Now, what are serious games? So, serious games are games that have useful side effects, and this usefulness is on behalf of the player herself. Okay? So, serious games are about learning. For example, learning vocabulary for if you want to learn a foreign language.
You can do so via games, right? Because the game provides a context which your brain can network to
and kind of stick and hang the words that you're supposed to learn into these contexts in some sense, okay?
Now, this is for educational purposes. However, serious games are also games that are used for training. Sadly so, for example, when you investigate the
people that are using these predator war elements that shoot people down, or flight simulators in the civil sense.
So, yeah, these are also serious games, and in the first of these cases, serious really is a true word. It's also maybe about information, like things that kind of inform you about political realities, healthcare, and so on, right? Now, games with a purpose,
in a sense, seem to be very closely related, because these are also games, but they somehow have a side effect. And this side effect, in terms of games with a purpose, is not necessarily beneficial for the user herself. Yeah? These are games that are more or less fun to play, that produce, for example, data sets that then are useful for a totally different purpose. Okay? Good. So what's closely related to that, but not necessarily in a game sense, is human computation, right? Amazon Mechanical Turk, for example. You're using the protein computers inside the skulls of people to produce results. And if you do that on a massive scale, like using thousands of people, you can achieve really wondrous results from that, right? So human computation is when humans do, algorithmic work, okay? Crowdsourcing is a closely related term where you would source out work to the crowd people, right? So these are almost synonymous. However, games for the purpose are still games, and you might wonder what is this side effect that I'm talking about. So there's a group at LMU under the guidance of Francois D, and they're really focused on games for the purpose and serious games. And one of those games, which is called Article, is the game which is a tag matching game. And players are presented artworks, like paintings, for example, and they're supposed to tag these paintings or artworks. And once they, both players, so that's a two-player game, once those two players hit the same tag, they're rewarded points, right? So it appears totally stupid, but it kind of is addictive for at least a special kind of player, right? So people really use that massively and produce tags, okay? And then you can imagine these tags are really valuable for persons trying to do information retrieval on images, for example, okay? Because we know that images are notoriously hard to kind of index in terms of information retrieval, and that's using the brains of players for tagging those images is a quite clever strategy to produce rich metadata that you can use in semantic web-like fashion for image retrieval. And there's lots of refinements, okay? So if you, for example, kind of take the famous image of Van Gogh with his ear off, you know, the one with the really rough strokes, people would kind of tend to tag it with man and expressionist or impressionist, like orange background from the background and so on. So what can happen is that the tags are rather something that you would call obvious, okay? And in order to produce richer, semantically richer tags, what you can do is, take certain measures. For example, you can introduce sets of forbidden tags, In the case of the Van Gogh image, you could say that men and ear are forbidden, because they're so obvious. And then people, in their tendency to score and to perform, would try to use more exotic, semantically richer tags. Okay? And once you have the tags, you can do a lot of machine learning magic with that. Okay? Because tags are kind of a blurred way of describing things. Okay? And the opposite example is like logics, predicate logics that kind of form real, intensive theories. Okay? And in order to come up with something that is somehow in between that in terms of degree of formality, what you can do is you have tags that consist of the thing that is being tagged, the tag itself and the author. Tags are terms, right? I state something about an object. And we might talk about singular value decomposition and its application in principal component analysis. And these are all strategies that find latent structures in seemingly unstructured data. Okay? So, in a sense, you can think of that as some sort of clustering or dimensionality reduction. And a PhD student at this group employed the newer technique that was invented by a Belgian mathematician, where instead of two-dimensional matrix space, as we did in the use entropy composition on these three-dimensional matrices of text.
And the results are quite promising there, because these tensor decompositions have mathematical properties that are way more convenient than the 2D matrix-based methods. Okay? Good. So, ending up, what we had was types and meta types, okay?
So, the meta types are simulation, online, social, mobile, location-based, clearly overlapping, as I said, and non-exhaustive. And the types were hardcore, casual, pervasive, and serious. And we propose, or at least it's one proposal, to classify games in terms of a two-dimensional vector of these types and meta types. And actually, these are not really independent, right? As you can see, there is some emphasis along the diagonal of this matrix. So, for example, hardcore games are rarely mobile. They might become mobile, but these days they're not, okay? Hardcore games are also not typically location-based, and simulation games are rarely casual, because they kind of have to learn rules and stuff to kind of move this virtual world and so on. So typically, there's, as indicated by those circles, there's a connection between those two axes, okay? Good. So, before we talk about genres, which will kind of, more or less form the end of this classification, let's do a wrap-up, okay? Once again, why did we say all the things or talk about all these things? So, the story is that we want to kind of describe what a social game is, and in order to do so, we must look at things like components, players, rules, and typologies. Okay? Once we have that, we can very briefly talk about genres. We would then have a conceptual framework that in which we can discuss commonalities and differences to social media on a constant basis. Okay? So in the next lecture, we will be extending this just a little bit in terms of some socio-psychological aspects. So we will talk about what is motivation, what is flow, why is it important for social media and games. And we will very briefly talk about socio-psychological studies in terms of communities and stuff. Very briefly. We will then go to social media and then we will be in Paris. Okay? Now, last point. For the gamers only, right? So the registration for the lab course groups is already finished, right? And as I said, I pretty much tossed together those persons that would be just single groups or groups of two, okay? Now the problem for those is to find their partners, okay? So we would have to do either, I would do mailing lists for them, which I probably have to do, okay? But we can do an experiment and see whether it's working here, right? And I will ask you to quickly raise your hand. So who's in group one? Okay? And that's already a complete group, I presume, yeah? If it's not, I will not ask any time. Who's in two? Okay, so please, the ones that have doubts, which persons they should contact, yeah, have a few. Who's in group three? Nobody. Four? Five? Six? Seven? Okay. Eight? Nine? Ten? 11? 12? 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 or 18, 19 or 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. Okay? So hopefully you would have your connections to the people that you need. If not, please write your tutors an email and we might set up meetings. Okay? So thanks for listening. We'll be around tomorrow at 8.